Scott's film Blade Runner, Pris, a replicant, walks in on J.F. Sebastian in this strange, overcrowded set of digs he shares with all these mechanical and biological things he lives with. And she says, "It must get lonely in here." And he says, "Not really. I make friends. They're toys. My friends are toys. I make them. It's a hobby." And when Jeremy asked me to speak at Deconstruct this year, I thought I'd try to draw a line through my personal work and realized I'd describe almost everything I've worked on as toys. I looked at my menagerie of Twitter bots and the strange pieces of software I create for fun and realized I'm this strange J.F. Sebastian figure. And so the talk today is called Making Friends. One thing I knew from a very early age is that toys do not magically appear out of thin air. They're made. And I know that because I grew up in a house where toys were made. My dad was a civil servant, and in his spare time, he worked as an amateur woodworker. And he turned pens and candlesticks and puzzles, and sometimes he'd make toys. I think they were for me. They sometimes seemed to be for him, too. So I'm going to illustrate the talk today with some pictures of toys he made, and we'll see where they go from there. I should also say that growing up with my dad like this meant that I misunderstood what the word shed meant, because I would say shed and I meant this place. It's now set up as basically a metalworking shop, but back then it was made of wood. So I would say shed, and my friends didn't quite see this in their head. Later, I'd grow up and I'd make toys, first out of Lego. I made that on my third birthday, hence the number. And nowadays I make toys out of code. And I wonder if I make toys in my spare time because my dad made toys for me. So what I'm going to talk today is not about the toys themselves, but I'd like to talk about the values of toy making, like my dad did, like I do, and what I discovered through making toys. So perhaps a good subtitle for the talk is Toys, Toying, and Toy Making. So what do I mean when I say toys? Not just things for children, and not just physical things either. Toyishness is a quality, I think. I think the best thing I got to when I was scrolling this presentation down was small concepts that can and should be played with. It's kind of terrible, really. They don't have to be physically small, but I think good toys explore small, single ideas. It's why whenever I say toy, I do this hand action. It's like toys, you know. Something you can fiddle with, a little nugget of an idea to get your hands around. So in that sense, maybe toys are simulations. This model of a digger is a simulation. It's a baked beans can for scale. I think Dad made this when I was 9. It's relatively realistic. The tracks are made out of individual bits of wood. It slides back and forward. It's got a working claw. It can shift sand. So in that sense, it's a simulation of a digger. Toys can be brilliant places to explore with new ideas. You fiddle with a concept and see what will happen, and there isn't any risk because it's just a toy. You know, the real world is a bit like Action Man. It has realistic moving parts. It's not static. We have to fiddle with it to explore it. So a static description, like a book or an essay or even a TV program, isn't always the best way to explain how something richly interactive works. Wouldn't it be better if you could pick it up and fiddle with it and change it and take it apart, see what happens, reappraise it, and maybe your worldview changes? That's the scientific method. And we all learnt it when we were 6. So, you know, SimCity is this game that nominally simulates the workings of a city. It lets you see how your interactions alter the landscape, how changing the tax alters your citizens' happiness, how zoning the town differently alters it. You're learning about cause and effect. Well, yes, but it's not a very good simulation. It's not nearly detailed enough to serve as a real simulation of cities. And the early versions are based on really outdated 1950s urban planning ideas. What it is good at, though, is being an abstraction of all those things, emphasizing the key moving parts. So it's not a good simulation, but it is a very good toy. And, you know, it really does strike me that all of Maxis's games are lousy simulations, but they could be so much better retitled if they showed you what they were. They're little pocket universes just to play with. So the value of toys, I think, that you can fiddle with and learn through those interactions is precisely not that they're detailed simulations. And if you look at the digger, you'll notice the big nuts on it are ridiculously out of scale. Instead, the elements they highlight, the moving claw or the way zoning affects a city, are important, and the stuff they leave out is also important. So to that extent, maybe toys are caricatures. This is a great model of a tow truck, right? It lets you play with the winch, it lets you haul it up and down, it lets you haul the claw up and down, and there's a little hook on the underside of the other car that you can pick it up with. It doesn't have a model of an internal combustion engine. It doesn't have moving doors. It just focuses on the core truckness of it. And it turned out that a lot of my favorite projects succeed because they're caricatures of a thing rather than an actual simulation. So this is a project I did that's four Twitter bots that talk to one another, and they sound like the characters in Valve's game Left 4 Dead. They say things that the characters might say in an adventure. They banter with one another. So what I was doing here was I was simulating conversation. There are loads of rules behind it. They'll occasionally get in trouble and ask for help. They sometimes get frightened and ask their friends. And occasionally, one or two of them will get killed. The state machine that ran this was getting more and more complex as I wrote it. And it was beginning to approach the complexity of sort of writing a game engine, which is ridiculous because they're just talking. They're not actually playing anything at all. So I radically simplified it. I track a few things. I track which big monsters in play, but I don't do anything like counting zombies. Zombies, it turns out, are binary. They're either zombies or no zombies. And if there are zombies, there's combat. Again, combat doesn't randomly happen. It's like, if there are zombies, they're shooting the zombies. There's no ammunition. Because it turns out, if an actor just occasionally yells that they're reloading to another actor, you get the feeling they're in this tense combat situation. And so I stripped out all these rules, made it a lot simpler. I also faked out the way the dialogue runs. Rather than responding to each other in real time, I basically wrote the scripts ahead of time and gave it to the robots, and they just read it out in order, like a radio play. That was mainly because I didn't want to explore responding to stuff in real time. I just wanted to explore generating scripts. Everything that wasn't relevant to what I wanted to explore got stripped out. We weren't making a simulation of a game. We were making a caricature of it. This is another ridiculous project that's a caricature. I was talking to a friend of mine who had just begun typing descriptions of the Christmas box from the back of the Christmas box of chocolates into Twitter, and it's this ridiculously purple prose. It's terrible. And so I thought it would be really fun to generate this stuff automatically forever, because Twitter is the place where you can take a good idea and then make it happen automatically forever and prove if it's actually funny. So Mark of Chocolates just sits there, and about once every 3 or 4 hours, it just lists chocolate descriptions. So how does it do this? It's an exploration of a mathematical idea called Markov chains. Markov chains often get used in natural language simulation. They are not to do with language. They're simply about probability. They're a memoryless random process. So the idea is, I'm in a state, and there are lots of probabilities I might go to another state, and I go to the next state based on one of those probabilities. So it's 0.7, I'll do this, but 0.3, I'll do that. And then when I'm in the new state, we start again. But there's no history. So if you were to do that and keep repeating that process, but your probabilities were some source text and the likelihood of a word following another word, so you got the word milk, and about 90% of the time the word chocolate follows it, and you put that down, and then 90% of the time in follows it, and so forth, you start generating this strange kind of English. This system knows nothing about grammar. It is about 50 lines long. It's just probability. And it creates an entertaining caricature of prose. One of the reasons it's good is because this is the source text. This is not what it generates. It's all the same. It's all these adverbs and adjectives. And so that very constrained corpus makes something very funny. That's kind of the most important thing. It's the fraction of the effort of natural language work. But it makes me laugh. And I think what's really important about caricature is the breadth of the stroke, how aggressive you are in that abstraction. Because if you find the right thing and amplify it, that's what makes it really good. Make the really broad bit really broad and just strip everything out, just like the pickup truck. You're making that really core idea evident through that abstraction. So toys are also a space to explore your craft. Many of my toys are digital. You could call them mechanical toys. And mechanical toys have this lovely long history. This is a brilliant book that I read when I was working on this talk by Brian Sutton Smith, who's a great play theorist. And this is a social history of toys, basically. And he talks about mechanical toys, which come about at the beginning of the 17th century. And they're very much tied to two inventions, the idea that the microscope and the telescope come in really quick succession, about 10 years apart from one another. And Sutton Smith calls this a revolution on the part of the miniature. All of a sudden, the very small and the very far away can now be seen and worked with. And so what emerges from this, as well as revolutions in science and optics and astronomy, is that craftsmen start showing off. Because a really easy way to make magic is to make something so small you can't believe it can work. We gasp and we ooh and ah when we see an iPod Nano. How have they fitted an iPod in there? Well, you know, this is the iPod Nano of the day. This is the automaton. It's an uncanny little drawing man who will draw on a bit of paper. How can it do that? The answer is there's a very skilled craftsman, almost a watchmaker, building these complicated mechanisms. And when you can make mechanisms that small, you can make mechanical toys, things that become small enough to grasp and to play with, to understand with your hands. It's also worth noting the work in this era is beautiful. So this summer I was working in Paris, and this is in the Musée Arts and Métiers in Paris. It's their sort of museum of science and technology and craft, and it's staggeringly good. These are all made of wood, and they have no purpose whatsoever. They're just somebody showing off, but they're beautiful. So actually they do have a purpose. They demonstrate craft. They're attractive to look at. I hope you can see this. So this is a pair of interlocking gears, one of which looks like a Maltese cross. And that works. You turn the bottom thing and it lumbers around. And there are all these fantastic elliptical and odd-shaped gears of somebody just showing off what they can do. But I think my favorite thing in this as an illustration of what you can do are these. Did anybody see these last year? This is a pair of dueling pistols that Christie's sold. And I'm just going to let you see this short film about.
The mechanism, which is composed of several hundreds of screws, wheels, levers, is an ingenious masterwork where every piece has its specific position and is pushing the bird out of the barrel the minute you activate it. And on a small pin, the bird is flipping upwards to sit on the barrel. And then within that tube, all the commands for its wings, the tail, and the beak are activated.
And all the music as well. They're that big. It's staggering. So they're all demonstrations of skill and craft, but they're also explorations of what is even possible. So these craftsmen, they're making toys and explorations in the materials and techniques they work with for a living. And, you know, many of these pieces will go on to be sold. Those would be built for a client. But also they create a buzz and a name for yourself and let you explore particular ideas you might not otherwise get to do. So the big parallel for me is the demo scene. Matt Westcott at Electromagnetic Field last weekend basically called it the biggest digital art movement you've never heard of. You might have heard of it. So you might remember, if you grew up in the 90s, the intros to cracked ST and Amiga games where things would bounce around the screen. And this is basically a group of Scandinavian guys fitting extra code into the bootloader of the disc to show off that they can fit these amazing real-time graphics into the beginning. So this, that's running in the background, I hope, and the sound's going to come up, is Second Reality by Future Crew. This was a PC demo from 1993. It's 9 minutes long. We're not going to watch it all, but it's got real-time deformation. It's got some lovely sprite scaling in it. It's got a lot of generated Soundblaster techno. What these people are doing is rather than embedding stuff in the as video or sound, they're generating it algorithmically. And what emerged from the early days of software cracking and showing off their skills through art was, frankly, competitive culture of trying to make things that challenged one another, pushing the boundaries of what's possible. The demo scene used to focus on working around some very limited constraints, the C64, the Amiga, the bootloader of an ST disk. And now we have very powerful computers. So what you see in the demo scene is demos that really explore new constraints. They set new challenges. So for instance, one of my favorites and a fairly legendary video is Elevated by RGBA. So, you can hear, there's a soundtrack. This is a real-time 3D flyby of a texture-mapped hazy mountain. This is in a class of competition called 4K, so this is a 4-kilobyte executable. The sound's in 4K as well. There's no data. This is all algorithmically generated and streamed off disk. and it's about 4 minutes long. And you can see it on Puit.net if you want to see the whole thing. So this is constraint, really pushing people to make something. But not something useful, not something interactive. Just exploring an idea. This is Craft. Craft runs on a 20 megahertz 80 mega 88, so it's a bit more powerful than an Arduino. If we can get the sound up a little bit whilst I talk, because it sounds pretty good. So there's software. He's also written his own VGA interface. He's also written his own sound interface. He's built the board it runs on, and it runs off a 9-volt battery. There's some nice real-time 3D and particle effects later. It's kind of brilliant. And it has a catchy melody. We're not going to sit through 4 minutes of this. These are all blisteringly creative and entirely aesthetic takes on what you can do with technology. And they're not necessarily useful for any meaning of that. But they have value to their creators. As well as being creative works, they are space to explore ideas free of certain constraints like work, but sometimes spurred through other constraints like file size or platform. They have a similar shape. An idea or inspiration leads to some exploration and results in a polished, if not immediately useful, toy. Do not mistake utility for purpose. These toys are not without purpose. They might be without utility, but those two things are not the same. Purpose and meaning, the understanding you come to through making these toys, may not be evident at the beginning of making them. It often emerges through the act of making. And then if it doesn't emerge through making, it might emerge through playing it. I'm going to show you two more examples of my own work. This is a project called Ghost Car. Ghost Car, I made to see how viscerally I'd react to encountering myself. It's inspired by two things. It's inspired by James Weir's Twit Shift, and also, I guess, Time Hop. So services that basically echo you on Twitter a year ago to where you are. What's interesting about Twit Shift is it echoes it to Twitter, to a second account. And Kevin Slavin has talked a lot about how when they were working on a game called Crossroads at Area Code, a game in which an imaginary AI monster chased you around New York. So he was just a set of coordinates in a computer. At one point, the coordinates passed through the office, and they had six early GPS phones rigged up, and they all just vibrated themselves off the table as the ghost passed through. Everyone knew it wasn't real, but it still created a visceral jump. So Ghost Car is based on the idea of the ghost car in Mario Kart and Ridge Racer, where your high score is represented as an invisible car to race against. Except I have a secret invisible me on Foursquare who goes where I was a year ago. So he was at the Brighton Dome. I took this about 3 days ago. He was at the Brighton Dome last year, except if I'd been here a few days ago, I could have met myself. Only I can see him. He's private. And the terms and conditions are quite tricky because they say I can't imitate other people. This is okay, right? I hope it's okay. I haven't got in trouble. What was interesting was what I discovered having made this. So I started checking in more because all of a sudden I went, oh my God, I have to have good data for next year. So I started using it a lot more. And then it started really reminding me how visceral places can be. I see certain pubs I don't go to very often come up, and I remember what party I went there for, who I saw. I remember the movies I saw at cinemas. I remember terrible exhibitions I saw at galleries, all through just seeing that name come up in my stream. Because it turns out you can remember exactly a year ago very well. And I didn't plan to find any of that out. It emerged through making it, from playing with one idea. This is some work in progress about, it's just a thing for me at the moment, about exploring new ideas of how you can interact with imagery in rooms. So in this case, it's about looking at time-lapse. This is a time-lapse of Mousel Harbour I shot. It's designed to sort of be on a static frame in a room. And you'll notice that as I wander around my living room, the nearest person to the camera scrubs the time-lapse left and right. And it's a very interesting way of sort of interacting with motion video. I didn't really know a good way of showing a time lapse, but I've got this magic picture frame that you just leave it there, and as you wander through the living room, you make it start and stop. So that's just a little idea, right? That was an hour and a half of hacking around with some code. But what's it done? Actually, I've now started shooting more time lapses because I now understand the qualities of time lapse that are nice to walk by. I'm looking at some new interactions. I've got one time-lapse that's nicer to walk towards and away from. And I've got some things that aren't time-lapses too. So actually, but just by making this, I've already had new ideas about the kind of imagery that would look good on it. That happened way after the what-if of maybe I could walk by my TV and the Kinect could track me. Thought happened. So don't dismiss the value of making a toy if you're not quite sure why. You know, sometimes when Seb was saying, I just do it because it's there, that's actually a very important attitude. He can tell you why he likes it when he's made it. We expose purpose and meaning through the making of these things. Gary Penn, who is an old games journalist and works at Denki, came up with this word, toyetics. Really like it. So Aristotle had his poetics, which, I don't know if you've read them, they're a treatise on what drama is and should be, and he was sort of right for the constraints of the day. And toyetics, are the qualities that make something a toy, the affordances that they embrace and demonstrate. So when I was thinking about this, I came to a topic that my former colleague Matt Jones introduced me to, which is an idea of Matthew Chalmers, called seamful design. This overlaps a bit with a lot of what Scott was talking about this morning, about how we actually need to transition between all the different things in the world. It's not designing for slickness or seamless interoperation, but emphasizing those things, emphasizing the gaps and the edges of things. Seams in interactive systems design and infrastructure show how through users' interaction, we can design for such seams. We can help users understand and adapt our systems and their activity with designs that weave transparent use and more analytical use together into what Wise are called the fabric of everyday life. This comes from an academic paper, but there's a lot of value in there, this idea of jumping over the humps. And I remember that Matt did this talk at Interesting about 5 years ago, and he said, toys radiate playfulness and opportunity. Well, how do they radiate those things? And I'd say they radiate them through their affordance with the edges, all the seams, these seams they have, seams for people who play with them, the seams that with all the actions you can perform with them, and the ways you can mess around with them with other toys. So, you know, Lego is seams all the way down, right? It's got these bubbles that just say, stick stuff to me. Every block is a whole collection of seams. But also, Lego plays well in Saarinen's next largest context, you know, because everybody's taken a Lego minifig and put it in a toy that wasn't a Lego toy. Everybody's stuck Lego onto other stuff. This is a Rolls-Royce Silver Ghost my dad made, and what's not visible in this picture is when you turn the steering wheel, the front wheels turn, which is, of course, Lego Technic rack and pinion steering. Lego fits everywhere. So Twitter's Lego, right? Because it joins most things to most other things through code and plain text. It's not a messaging service, it's a messaging bus. And that's why I created this slightly infamous project, which is I put Tower Bridge. It connects one thing, Tower Bridge, to another thing, the internet, via a really obvious seam. Twitter is on the internet, and the Lyft times are available as text. So I built this for a tiny bit of utility, but I also wanted to explore a very weird seam, which is like, what is it like, being friends with a bridge? What's it like when a bit of infrastructure sits in your timeline? It's really weird, that's what it is. But then, like water flowing through cracks, other seams emerged. Lots of my friends emigrated around this time, sometimes to go to Europe, sometimes to go to work in the valley or on the West Coast, and they kept following it because it was a little bit of home they could take with them. A bunch of cab drivers follow it, so that when it tells them it's going up, they avoid Tower Bridge approach. That information was always available before, but it was leaking through a different set of edges. And so just by messing around with this, we found these seams to interconnect with other people. And that's the most important seam for toys, where they connect to people who play with them. Toys are incomplete without people. And toys change when people start to join with them. Because when you interact with a toy, play happens. And play is this verb I use to mean so many different things. That means interact and explore and joke and subvert and share and God knows how many other things. All these things that I'm calling toys are about this very pure, focused kind of interaction. They pride interaction above all things. Now, they may be branded, and they may tie into existing properties, but they don't have content. They just have interaction. The story doesn't live in them. It lives in you. And this is the second half of Matt's quotation from Interesting. And this one always gets me. It gets me right there. Stories are the contrails left by toys as they roar through our world and our imaginations. Isn't that the biggest seam of all? Isn't it marvelous that the act of play can inspire so much? So, you know, this is why Toca Boca's toys are popular. This is Helicopter Taxi. Do you know Helicopter Taxi? It's an iPhone app, and it's just that. It's a helicopter in your phone, and occasionally it has to land somewhere. So you run around with it and land it, and then when it's not moving, the helicopter lands and some guy gets out. And then he says, take me to the hospital, and you pick him up and you run around with it. That's it. It's brilliant. It's just a helicopter in your iPhone. Oh, Make Go by Chris O'Shea. This is wicked. It's an app, again, and it's just a little man in a car, and he looks up at you, and there isn't a car. You have to build the car around it. So here he's made it out of Lego, but you could make it out of cardboard. And then you drive it around, and flames come out the back, and the little man sometimes goes, fill it up. You have to put fuel in, and you drive it around. But it's this incomplete toy saying, stick stuff on me. And the most exciting thing about Makies, so I don't know how many of you know these, they're very popular. They are print-on-demand dolls. They're posable. You can customize them to your specification, which is amazing. You can spend 100 quid and literally get a thing you just saw on screen as CG, but now it's in your hands. And that is not my favorite thing about them. This is my favorite thing about them. My Instagram stream and my Flickr stream are full of these pictures. These are grown men and women playing with a doll, which is brilliant. What I was really, I wasn't sure if people were going to play with them. And they do, and this is photos of people literally having fun with their dolls, making all these contrails, all these stories that only come about when they have a mad scientist that works in an ad company. This came out this week. This guy glued Lego to his Makey. Well, he Sugru'd it to it. And now he can turn it into these mechas. It looks like Centurions. It's awesome. He's like in his 30s and runs a digital media firm, but he's also making robots. But I think the best kind of toys are the really abstract ones. This is beautiful. This is, I think I had this when I was 2. It's called a clacker. It's about 3 foot long, and it has a little bit of plastic that scrapes against these dowels, and there's a bell in it. Sorry. So what's that? I'll tell you what it is. It's a Hoover. It's a lawnmower. It's a dog you can pull behind you. It's a mallet or a hammer. Sometimes it's a guitar. Sometimes it's who knows what. It doesn't have any desire or intended use. It only desires to be played with. It is seams all the way down. And that's another important thing. I'm sorry, I'm going to be about 5 minutes over, I'm afraid. As well as all these seams, it still has this lovely finished quality to it. And this is really important. Toys are finished. Seams are not rough edges. So toys have seams, but please finish them. You know, don't leave cables dangling. That was where I shot the original time-lapse. Put it in a box. Shave off the rough edges. Make sure it doesn't need instructions to explain it, because good toys are self-evident. That's really easy to forget when you want to make a new thing, but a good toy has this condensed quality to it. Toys are not prototypes. They are experiments, but they're also artifacts in their own right. They are charming and beautiful and interesting, just like those demo scene videos, just like the showpieces of the 18th century. We make prototypes to explore a material or an interaction or an aesthetic, but prototypes are about utility, and once we know what we want to know, we move on. Prototypes are not about finishing. And I think toy making really is, even if it explores a single idea. It's about taking an idea through execution to a point when it can be played with. And that's important. Until something's finished, it's just an idea. The most staggering piece of design this summer, I think, was Thomas Heatherwick's Olympic Cauldron. And I went to the retrospective of his work that's on at the V&A. And there were these little phones that most people ignore where they had interviews. And there was this incredible interview with him in which he said, you don't want to fall in love with an idea. And more specifically, if an idea is so good that you want to see it in the world, you should be dying to make it. You should get it out of your head, because the longer it lives in your head, the longer it grows and spirals and you start imagining things that might not be possible. You mustn't be seduced by that. You must get things into the world, which is hard work. And this is why the small scope of toys is really valuable, because frankly, it means you can finish more stuff. About 2 years ago, I deliberately started making way smaller stuff in my spare time. If it had a login system, I could never finish it. I just had to make tiny things. James Bridal spoke here a couple of years ago, and a friend of mine once said, Bridal, I think, is the best software developer I know. And I've seen James's code, and I pulled a bit of a face. And this other software developer, who I greatly respect, said, no, I'm serious. Because in terms of the number of ideas he has to the number of things he makes, his ratio is off the scale. And that is the only one that matters. Get stuff finished and get it real. And I think toys are a lovely place to do that. So as I was making this talk, I wasn't sure where I was going, and I had a flat full of playing cards all over the floor because I wrote it on playing cards. And the purpose became clear as I wrote it. Go back to this diagram for a second, and that seam between a toy and a player. That seam left for a person. So when you play with a toy, you're kind of making a bit of it too. But when you're making it, and you're building that toy, you have to imagine the player. You have to imagine what they'll do. And so that means to design those edges, we have to think like a player ourselves. We have to be playing with it whilst we make it. And that's weird. That's unusual. And that, for me, is the big value of toy making. Joan Erickson pointed out that she thought the opposite of play wasn't work. She said the opposite of play is obey, because in play or even in work, you can do as you please. And the moment someone tells you to do something, it stops that. Play is a freedom you can choose for yourself. And by doing so, you approach the world differently. You start seeing it as something to fiddle with, like the simulation toys, as a place to explore new ideas, as a place to leave seams, even if you don't know what they're going to do. In toy making, you leave a space for the player, and by doing so, you end up playing yourself. That is the biggest value of toy making to the designer or maker today. The idea that making is playing. Toy making gets you away from the constraints of utility, and worst of all, of solving problems. And problem solving is this convergent idea. There is a problem, and we approach it with solutions, and then we move on. And that is very satisfying. I do a lot of that in my daily life. I'm sure you guys too. But we're obeying the demands of a problem. Toy making is divergent. There's an idea. We radiate outwards. We explore and we play, and we just see what happens. Problem solving is important and useful, but so is divergent thought. And toy making is not idle, and it's not purposeless. Purpose emerges through making. So if you start making things with purpose, purpose will emerge. Do not make things idly, and your making will not be idle. Instead, trust in what you learn from exploring a material you already know or want to get to know. Trust in your skill as a craftsman or a designer or an artist. Trust in the materials you're working with. Trust in abstracting away all the things that don't matter to your core idea. Trust in the fact you'll finish things. And trust in play. Because sometimes the only purpose you need to seek with toys is play. Now, I thought that that might just be playing with them, like my friends playing with their makies. But it turns out what my dad found out was that making them can be play enough. And I now find that as I make machines that talk in ridiculous sentences or chase me around the world or skitter through photographs as I walk through my flat. Toys inspire. And toying leads to new ideas. And toy making is about much more than making just toys. So I hope you find time to play with your work a little. Thank you very much.